Welcome to Took Talk, a video podcast by the band Took, and brought to you by Black Frog Media. We chat with the best in the music industry from yesterday and today, with a focus on the good old days of Canadian rock. This episode originally streamed live on Tuesday, October 20th, 2020 on Facebook Live. Now, here are your hosts, Todd, Brent, Shane, Corey, and Darren.
Hey, hey. Oh, different Hi. Gals.
You're showing Took. I'm showing C-3PO's sexy torso for some reason. It's a very homoerotic, like, very specific in its own, like, you know, if you're really into robot dudes.
If you're going to make a cop with it with C-3PO on it, why don't you put his face on, not his, like...
And that's his back.
This is for the diehards.
Oh, yeah.
The face would be too recognizable.
Right. There's somebody out there just right now complaining, well, this isn't accurate because this is, you know...
Yeah.
for the same reason that they have to put the phonetics on the... on your toque mug there, you know? The proper pronunciation.
That's so people can understand how...
Yeah, whereas we all know, right? So, for the layman's.
But it is funny how, like, everybody else is like, Toke. How's Toke doing? Or whatever, you know?
That's right.
Toke. Yeah, I think that's what they say in Japan. Toke. Toke.
Toke. Toke.
Hi, everybody. Sorry.
Hi. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Just to me.
How are you? We're doing a live show. Hey.
No Fitz today. He's on his way back home. So he is probably somewhere... Middle America, I would imagine.
Fitzy, I'm coming home.
Yep. So after his quick 5 month stay up in Canada, he ventured back home the other day.
He was asked to leave.
We can't say bad things about him because he's probably.
Oh, no, we can. That's the best part because he's in a dead zone, so he can't.
Oh, okay.
Did he go up to Salt Lake or further south? Do you know? Have you done that?
I have done the trek, but I don't recall which route he's taking. He stopped here the other day. I know he took off late at night and then was venturing down through like Colorado, I think. So, I mean, because reported snow, which unfortunately is here. So,
golly,
you can see out my window, it's snowing.
How long have you had snow now?
This is about the first. So, yeah, he got out of here just in time. Yeah. I mean, I think we've had like a few days of a little, you know, snow shower here and there, but I mean, I think it's getting cold enough now where it might just stick around. So,
well, it's 85 here, real feel 90. So,
yeah. It's what cold in Vail. Let me tell you, it was cold, like minus eight Fahrenheit. So,
Innis Vail, Alberta.
Yeah. So it's like minus 16 or something Celsius.
Dang. Well, let's check what it's like in Lanigan, Saskatchewan.
Okay, Google, what's the temperature in Moose Jaw?
The current temperature in Moose Jaw is 30 degrees. Due to current wind conditions,
just below,
like it's 19.
Just below freezing, not too bad.
Yeah,
right.
In the jaw.
That's my jaw.
Yeah. Okay, Google, stop.
You never know. I remember it used to be. If you know, Halloween was the kind of the breaking point. I mean, if you could make it to Halloween without snow in Canada, you were doing good.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, not the case. So
I don't remember Halloween ever not having snow. It was always like snow suits with a shitty Frankenstein plastic thing over top of you.
Oh yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, like Jerry Seinfeld says, you know, it's like, what are you supposed to be? Look at the pants. You know, I'm Superman.
So the go-to was always Jason from the movie, right? Because it was already like a snowsuit sort of thing. You just had to put a goalie mask on. You were there.
Yeah, exactly. And goalie masks were aplenty up there. So
It seemed like a day or maybe a week before, it would always, every year, it would snow.
Like 100%. 100%.
Well, yeah, because, you know, as kids in Canada, you get like 4 days to look forward to. So why not ruin as many of them as you can, right? I mean,
you shift everything forward a few months, like, you know, exactly. We're having Halloween in like July. I think that
is Halloween a thing down where you are. Like,
I was going to say, they're recommending not to do it. So there may be some that come out, and I'm worried that I might get egged because I'm gonna make the windows dark because I don't think it's a good idea.
I would have egged you. I honestly.
Yeah, but I might get egged.
It might have been just random anyway. We didn't know. Yeah, I saw something where like Carson Daly on Instagram, you know, the host, built some sort of PVC pipe type thing. So he kind of puts it, here you go. And it goes down like 6 feet or something like that to the kids thing.
I'm just gonna put a big ass bowl of treats at the end of the driveway, and in typical 2020 fashion, it's just gonna be full with those freaking kisses, those things with all the Halloween marking. Because I mean, how much worse can 2020 get other than give those away to to kids? So figure what the hell.
Let them take as many as they want. What was the worst candy when you were growing up?
That one right there.
That one?
Yeah, of course. Who wants that?
The kisses? What?
Not Hershey's kisses. Oh, I think, okay. You know those blobs of brown tar that are wrapped in the Halloween.
We called those black cats.
Oh, okay. Well,
I think if they're giving you black tar, that might have been on purpose.
I mean, it's more of like a brownish
kind. It looks like hash oil.
Yeah. I mean,
it could have been.
Yeah. Brown tar heroin. There you go.
I thought they were called kisses for some reason. I don't know. They probably were so awful they didn't even have a name, but you just knew them,
They were the last thing you ate.
Yeah.
No, the apple.
That gum Thrills was weird too.
They still sell that here. The one that tastes like soap. It actually says right on the package, still tastes like soap. It's like,
wow. I don't know what that is. Thrills?
Yeah.
Thrills gum.
It's purple gum that tastes like soap.
It does.
I love that. That's actually a selling point now.
We'll have to check in a cilantro way. I think we'll have to check with our guest on that one. I don't remember that one being in Alberta. Thrills.
Maybe not. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, there's some bad candy out there. What would your go-to giveaway be? Corey, I'd be interested to hear what you say, too. I mean, obviously, chocolate's a big thing at Halloween. What is a vegan give out for Halloween candy?
Right. Well, chips.
The worst stop ever. Celery?
Here's a fucking potato, kid. Get on your way.
I always liked chips as a kid, getting chips or chocolate bars. So chips is fine, and... Also, the skinny pop popcorn, those kinds of things,
Or like when you go like to Old Man Wilson's giving out full cans of Coke. You run over his head. A full can of Coke. Down it before you get home. So you just
Oh, that's exactly what you do. You just come home and you trade your different hat, go back around,
Exactly.
No sense wasting any energy getting some crap candy. Just stick 30, to what
35 years old.
Exactly.
What are you supposed to be? A 35-year-old? It's an amazing costume.
That's great. No doubt. Well, that's great. So we've touched on a whole bunch of nothing, and that's awesome. Yeah. That's what we do.
Perfect. Today.
And we've got what I probably will safe to say the most technically advanced guest that we've had on the show. So there's probably going to be 0% chance that we're going to have any,
you just jinxed it.
Internet
is.
Yeah. Audio. Cause I mean, he sounds better than everything.
Shane's going to fill up that quotient. My favorite is this one though. When it's like,
oh my God.
Hey, is the Skyper on? Is the Skyper on? No, but this gentleman is, close to the family, the Tuke family in particular. Yep. We'll touch on that a little bit. Who wants to do the intros? Intro.
Shane!
Alberta Brendan.
I have to Shane do it. And put his hand up too. So we're going to have to call on Shane. Yeah.
He is from Alberta, Edmonton, Alberta, which is like 2 hours north from where I grew up. And he's, what can you say about this guest? I mean, you check all the boxes with the stuff he's done. He's famous. He's a guitar virtuoso, amazing songwriter. I was just listening to a solo record actually this morning. It's amazing. You guys got to check it out if you haven't heard it.
Absolutely.
Who's he play with? Chris Cornell, Don Henley.
Melissa Etheridge,
Pink, and the list goes on.
He has a YouTube channel with over 200,000 followers.
Wow. Like 22 million views or something. Well, that's crazy.
And we're hoping to steal some of those likes this episode. So,
and
make sure to subscribe.
a lot of people don't know, but he plays with a huge artist in Japan. Tsuyoshi Nagabuchi is his name.
Easy and for you to say.
Where I met Pete in person, I'd heard about him for years and years and years. And then I was in Japan on Instagram and I saw Pete was there. I'm like, dude, what's up? Let's hang out. And I'd never actually met him before. So I met him on his birthday at a dinner party. So random, but that was the first time. But anyway, let's bring him on. Pete Thorne.
Yay! Yay! Welcome, Pete. Nice shirt, dude.
Got to represent.
Yeah, man, you're representing hard.
That's awesome.
Listen to that audio. It's fantastic.
Oh, wow.
This guy's a pro.
Let me tell you about the Samson G-Track Pro.
Oh, wow.
Wow, dude.
These guys mentioned my YouTube channel. For those that don't know, I've got a YouTube channel where I largely like demonstrate guitar and recording equipment and stuff like that. And that's become a big part of what I do. But my old day job was just guitar player guy.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Do you have an OnlyFans account?
It's called Patreon.
We can just mix that all up. Apparently, Pete Thorne's some kind of webcam girl. I don't know how
that works. Going on in that room. In that
I was describing what I do now to people, and one good friend of mine said, "So you're a cam girl, basically?" That's it.
Yes, for guitar players. Yeah, for musicians, sure. Yeah.
What's the term? YouTuber, right? Is that what it is?
I think influencer.
I
was at NAMM show a couple of years ago. I was hanging out with a guy that's got a great YouTube channel. This guy, Leo from Frog Leap Studios. He makes like amazing covers of songs that you wouldn't think of as hard rock or metal songs, but then he does them hard rock and metal. Cool. And he's had incredible success doing that. Makes really funny videos. He sings, he plays every instrument. He's one of those guys. He's been incredibly successful doing this. But he was saying that when he was coming into the NAMM show lives in Norway. And so he's flying in, and what's your occupation? For the first time, he said, it was so weird. I wrote YouTuber. You put on the customs form, you know? And he was like, even though he's done so well with it, it's amazing. That's a thing. But it's a thing. That's what we do.
It is. Corey,
Corey, you mentioned that you were going to be starting up your own channel. I didn't realize you were a cam boy yourself.
Camboy.
Look at this. Oh, Corey.
Yay!
All the way from Ireland.
Oh, bless your heart. Bless your heart. That was random.
That was for Corey Hart. That was not for you.
Corey Hart. Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead with your question, Corey.
So part of what you do on your YouTube channel is you review all kinds of gear, right? Like pedals and amps and what have you not. Even recording units. Do you keep all that stuff? And if so, where the hell do you put it all?
It's a problem. It's a lot of guitar pedals. So luckily they're small, but if I showed you what the floor looked like right now, it's literally like, here, I'll just take a picture and then I'll show you, but it's always chaos. It's like coming up is reviews of all these, like within the next, 10 days or a week or something. My floor is always littered with guitar
pedals.
That's
awesome.
Totally, and
it depends on the individual manufacturer, but it is kind of amazing the amount of stuff that ends up staying, but it's quality. If you would have told me when I was 14, people would send me all this guitar gear.
Right?
Yeah, it's
how did that all come about? Like, I assume you just started doing this for yourself and for fun, and then it just sort of turns into a thing?
Yeah, it was like 2006 is when I got a YouTube channel, and at first I didn't know what to do with it.
That's 14 years ago. That's so insane.
Yeah, it's crazy, right?
I know. Crazy.
And it's changed so much of what I do. I mean, honestly, it's a huge, it was kind of like this. I got the channel, and then I had right around the time that happened, maybe a year or two earlier, I'd bought my first kind of home studio recording. I got a Mac finally, and got to get into recording. Here we go. And I got Logic and learned how to use that, a simple pre-Sonus interface and a couple microphones. And then I start the YouTube channel. So it's like, well, I like this kind of project recording or whatever. Maybe I can just try and, make some lessons or something, or record tones and show how I'm getting them and that kind of thing. And so I did a lesson, a guitar lesson on how to play Eruption by Van Halen. Mm-hmm. And that video really, which it was back in the day when YouTube was, you could only do 15 minute videos. Okay, and quickly, wow. Once I started teaching, or, you know, filming it, teaching Eruption, I was like, oh, this is going to take a lot longer than 15 minutes. And so I had to break it into 5 videos because I didn't know how to tab or anything like that. So I was describing every single note as I went.
Because you could only do 9-minute videos back in those days, right?
It was 15. Yeah.
Oh, 15. Okay.
Yeah. So I broke it. By the time you do an intro and stuff, you're 5 minutes in almost. So it's like I had to break it into 5 videos. But I put that out and that really got some traction. Slow build, but like it started to get a lot of views, but more on that in just a second. Around two, so that was in 2008. 2007, I did a video for a company that I just kind of become associated with, which was Sur Guitars and Amps, my good friend John Sur. They had just made a new amplifier and I really liked it, and they gave me one of the very first prototypes actually for an artist price. And I thought, how can I show my appreciation for that? Because they were really kind to give me a good deal on this. And I thought, I got this recording gear. I got the YouTube channel. Maybe I'll just play some simple rock riffs through this thing and try and show what it sounds like and, you know, put it up on the YouTube channel. And so I did that. And just simply, you know, I was playing like Rebel and some ZZ Top and like just whatever cool rock riffs I could, you know, and tried to record it really well and present it well. They hit me up about a month or two after that and they said, hey, that video that you made, we're hearing a lot about it from our dealers. Like, we've sold out the whole first run of amps.
Wow.
And, you know, people are saying that was really helpful, the dealers, because they're a boutique company. And it was a product that you might not be able to, you know, you couldn't find any Guitar Center. It was like more like a boutique guitar shop kind of product.
Sure.
And so if you're in Des Moines, Iowa or something, maybe you couldn't get a hold of one of these or know what it sounded like. And it's a fair amount of money. And I guess it was useful for folks that wouldn't necessarily, you know, they don't know what it's going to sound like otherwise. So here was this thing you could listen to and get an idea of what it was going to do before you plunk down your money and order it. So they thought it was really helpful. And that's when the light bulb went off. I thought, oh, this is something to this, like, you know, this whole gear and show, you know, and so that happened. So then I had done the How to Play Eruption lesson as well. And something really interesting happened. I was playing with Chris Cornell and I was on the road in 2009. The last full tour I actually did with him in 2009. And we were in Lisbon, Portugal. And I'd played with, you know, I'd played with a fair amount of people as a sideman and done stuff up to that point. And folks knew me for that, if they knew me at all. They would be like, oh, you're that guy that played with so-and-so that I saw at the show. This guy comes up to me on the street before the gig, walking down the street, going to get some lunch, 2 p.m. or something, Lisbon, Portugal. And this guy comes up to me on the street and he pokes me in the chest and he goes, hey, you taught me how to play Eruption.
Wow.
And I was like,
that's amazing.
Yeah, literally on something that I'd filmed on my internal camera on my 2006 iMac, you know, that had somehow gone all the way around the world to this guy in Lisbon.
Wow.
He knew me from that. He didn't know me from playing with anybody or a sideman job I'd had or whatever. It was from this YouTube lesson. And was like, holy shit. Like, that's amazing that there's no middleman. There's nothing in between me and this guy other than the direct connection. And that was really when I saw the power of it, coupled with the story I told earlier about the gear, you know, and it all just kind of took off from there. Amazing. So I highly recommend, I mean, no matter what it is you do, if you're a really good cook, if you're a car mechanic, if you're a whatever, and you somehow have the, you know, penchant ability to film this stuff and get it out there, and you think you got something to offer that's maybe different than what you've seen other people do, there's a whole, it's a wild west still out there. I feel like you can really connect with people, and there's nobody to tell you that you're too old or too young or that you know what I mean? It's just that direct connection, and you're your own worst critic. Make something great and put it out there, and you never know, it might connect. And
have you found anything, have they made any changes to the YouTube world that have affected you in any other way? Cause I know that they seem to be kind of changing and clamping down and royal, you know, like, publishing becomes an issue and things like that. If
you're doing, I guess it depends what you're doing. Luckily I've avoided most of those issues because my thing, and this wasn't by design really, but I just like to write little songs, and I almost use the YouTube videos as a vehicle. It's almost like my official purpose there is to demonstrate a guitar pedal. But what I'm really actually doing is just taking this thing or whatever and plugging it in and then seeing what music comes out. And sort of forget that I'm making a video about this. This is the framework I have to work within. Let's see what sound this thing makes. Oh, let's write a riff. Okay. Let's produce a little track up around this. And I forget that, you know, and I just have to remember to kind of turn the camera on as I'm doing takes. and I write a song and basically produce it. And that's the fun part for me.
That's so cool.
It's really just a music delivery. Like every time. So in other words, if folks haven't seen my videos, there's always a little piece of music that starts every one, a minute and a half of an original piece of music. You know, and a long time ago, a guy told me, he says, I love the videos you make, because I wasn't always doing that. And he said, I love the videos you make, but you sometimes talk at the beginning and then you play later on in the video. He's like, move the music to the front of the video and see what happens. And I took that constructive criticism and I thought, I'm going to try that. And it was really successful because, you know, people have a short attention span. Yeah. And they'll click off it. Oh, check something out for 30 seconds and then click off. Well, at least if they've watched the first minute of the video, they've heard the thing that I'm demonstrating and they've heard this little song that I've written.
Sure.
And then the rest is optional. It's all gravy after that. So
there was a song that you, pedal that you did. It was kind of like an crazy octaver type pedal recently. Yeah.
This thing.
That thing is fucking amazing. Even more amazing was the song that you wrote for that. Was that your... Yeah, that's the thing right there.
What is it? What is that thing?
Badass.
It's a Jack White collaboration. That's right. Yeah, with Jack White and Copper Sound Pedals. And it's an amazing story. They shipped this thing with a book that is this thick on how they make this. And they spent 4 years making this pedal, which is like... A guitar pedal is like, you know, there can be some money made, but it's a pretty niche product. And it's like, I was just really amazed at the dedication because they figured out quickly they would have to, they're telegraph keys, but they had to fabricate them themselves.
That's so cool.
Yeah. The amount of stuff that they actually make on here is incredible. They don't buy it from other people.
Crazy.
And, but it does basically an octave up, an octave down, and then there's like a kill switch, or you can put a pedal in the effect loop on this thing and then hit this switch and it turns on that pedal.
Wow.
And so you could have a fuzz or... Yeah, so it's really amazing, but it's a lot of fun. And the song...
So you need to do something with that song because it was really, really cool. And if you don't, then Took is going to take it. We're going to write a Took song around it.
Okay. Yeah. That's cool. Through all Pete's riffs and start nabbing them.
Publishing guys on you guys. You could, you're all my
you know, do you just do reviews? Do you like get to cherry pick the gear that you do this stuff on? People send you stuff, or do you ever get like an episode where it's like, oh, this thing is like an absolute piece of garbage, and you know, like, or is it?
Yeah, that happens very rarely these days because I always say it's kind of guitar pedals these days. We live in this renaissance of guitar gear, this amazing time, like golden time of, you know, I don't know, it's maybe 20 or 25 years ago that the boutique thing came in, and it, you know, all of a sudden there's these guys in their garages making really cool pedals that, if some of those since have been like the Klon, for instance, has become a classic that you can barely find for, you know, they're $4,000 if you can find an original one on reverb.com now. So it was this whole like little cottage industry or something that blew up, and so consequently there's so much great gear out there. I compare it to coffee. It's like you can't find a bad cup of coffee. You remember in Canada in like the 80s or the 90s, it was like probably pretty hard to find a good cup of coffee.
And I love that bad coffee. I miss
that. Folgers. Maxwell House or whatever it was.
Folgers, yeah. Sanka.
Yeah, Sanka.
I only drink Folgers because of Paul Stanley's endorsement.
Yeah. What?
The best part of waking.
You've never seen the Paul Stanley Folgers commercial?
No.
Yeah. Oh,
wait.
Google that.
Unaired commercial. It never went to air.
That's amazing.
It's on YouTube, though, right?
Folgers.
Yeah. It's on YouTube.
High end. There was a point when Folgers was all of a sudden. Well, that's kind
of. It was the best part of waking up.
Right.
The Randy Travis version was a massive hit, though, let's be honest.
Oh, that's true.
Best part of waking up.
Folgers in your cup.
I think that sounded more like Dwight Yoakam there.
That is really what guitar is like, though. It's like you had your Folgers, your Maxwell House, your whatever, which was like your...
Sure.
And I'm almost doing a disservice because these people make great pedals, but you had your Boss, your MXR, your like your basic, your main food groups of pedals, and that was it, right? And then now you've got boutique and it's like beer. It's like it just exploded into like there's just so many options of like high quality, like crazy craft stuff. That's guitar pedals now. So if you make a guitar pedal now and it sucks, like it's not gonna last. It's just there's too many other good options. So because the quality's risen to a really high place. Every now and then I get something where it doesn't mean it makes a bad sound. It just means I don't understand what I'm supposed to do with it. So I'll politely decline to do it at that point and send it back.
Do you ever swear when you're making your videos? Because something's going wrong.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Mother,
God damn it!
I think you have to.
Yeah,
that's so funny.
Yeah,
maybe we can see an outtake someday of all that.
Yeah, the blooper reel.
You guys ever see this guy? He's a Canadian guy. Actually, lives in Windsor. Spectre Sound Studios. Do you know this guy?
Somebody else was telling me about this. What was it about
again? He's amazing. He just does reviews, and he is not afraid to, like, he'll be like, this thing is the biggest steaming pile of shit in life. Like, I can't even believe that the winner, who idiot designed this, and that's his video. And, of course, wow. They've got millions of views because they're like, so he literally, he took an amp from a manufacturer, I won't say who, but he's literally like, this thing deserves to die, and he shot it with a gun in the video. And like, crazy. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, he's amazing.
Yeah. Yikes.
Kind of goes the other way on those. Yeah.
He's great though. Yeah. He's actually, I met him and he's a really like mild mannered dude in person. It's kind of like on the videos, he goes crazy, but it's
don't offend him with a bad amplifier. Or anything,
yeah. That idea. Yeah.
Yeah. That is hilarious.
So going back to, we all come from the prairies, essentially, you know, the middle of Canada.
Yeah.
I've always been fascinated because I remember playing down in Los Angeles at a place called the Dragonfly over on Santa Monica, I guess it was.
Yeah, both and, Santa Monica and Cahuenga.
And you and Fitz showed up there. This is like 90, maybe, I don't know, dude, like late 90s.
Yeah.
So what is the impetus for young Pete Thorne growing up, Alberta? We had so many great bands and so much great music in a lot of ways that we all grew up around. A lot of cover bands and that kind of stuff. I assume, yeah. Did you... you know, do that? Like, once you kind of got into it, you got hip to playing in a cover band or anything like that? Or did you just bypass all that and said, I'm going to Los Angeles?
I kind of did. And I almost got into it, actually. Okay. God, I want to remember the name of the woman that I almost went out and started gigging with. You would remember her name, and I'm forgetting it now.
Band was started she a cover artist?
Yeah, like band started with band? An S. Trying to remember the name of the band.
Steelheart.
No,
from Edmonton. I think I know exactly who you're talking about. There was a girl singer. It's kind of like a Snow White kind of thing, but no, it's like, I can't remember, but there was China good. White.
Yeah, she was good, and I can't remember the name of the band, but she was totally on the same circuit as you know, I used to go see Click. I used to go see you guys. I mean, and you were one of the ones that I was like, okay, because Age of Electric.
Oh, Age of Electric, okay.
I remember seeing you guys in like 1989.
It's probably the late 60s, I think.
But you were amazing, man. I mean, what a great band. And I remember, like, and you were doing originals back then, right?
Yeah. Much to the chagrin of the clubs we were playing, but yeah.
But you were, which is to my point, like, you were one of the few where it was like, you know, and Click would too, and they'd throw them in, but it was, I could see that it was tough, you know?
Yeah.
And I got scared of that initially. And some other things were going on with my dad was having some business problems and stuff. And I thought I was about 18. I was 18 and I just graduated high school, and I had this opportunity. I'd applied to MI, to Musicians Institute in LA, and I'd applied for some grants and a student loan, all of which got approved. And I saw this window of like, with my dad's business troubles, I knew I couldn't get to LA on my own at 18 without a little help from my folks. And I thought, I don't know what's going to be going on with my dad and his situation in about 6 months or a year. Things might be different. It could be tougher for me, I felt like, and I should probably jump. And so I almost went on tour with the woman that I'm talking. I wish I could remember her name right now, but I can't.
So you bailed at 18 years old to Hollywood?
Yeah, I did.
Swimming pools, movie stars?
Not exactly. Three guys in a one-bedroom at the Oakwood in Burbank.
Yeah, that's the reality of it. Yeah.
That was 3 years before I came down here.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah, wow. I graduated in 94, so 93 I was here.
Okay, yeah, I started in 90, I guess. September 90 is when I headed down. So, and I did 90 to 91, and then I just kind of, you know, worked out ways to keep that going and stuff. And I never really, I didn't know what was going to happen, but I thought if I can just get down there, you know, and it seemed like the place to, I mean, this is pre-grunge. So it's like, you know, it was still, when I first got to LA, it was nuts. It was like still Sunset Strip, that whole thing. It was the waning days for sure, but it was
everybody happening. Thinks that on January 1st of 1990 that died, but it went on for years. I mean, that Sunset Strip thing happened way into the 90s. I mean, eventually it sort of wrapped up, but you know,
Yeah, about 93, 90, you know, things change. I remember I was playing with a band at the Troubadour, and it was a Friday night. Like, I clearly remember two things, seeing the Smells Like Teen Spirit video for the first time at my apartment in Hollywood and going, this is different, like very different.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I remember playing this a show at the Troubadour. I was living at that point on and off out in the kind of the Pasadena areas, and I didn't get into Hollywood that much. I spent time out there writing with a band and stuff. And I remember playing, we got this gig at the Troubadour, and we were opening up for the band Morphine, I think, and that night. And I remember playing the show, and it was 9:30 p.m. set or something. So it was probably 10:50, you know, at the Troubadour, where when you're done your set, they dump all your gear into the alley. Yeah, and you're like, I don't even have a place to park my car, and I got all this gear, can't leave it in the car. So I got in the car, drove up Doheny to Sunset Boulevard, and I took a right on Sunset Boulevard. So this is a Friday night at about 10:30 p.m. Okay. And I'm driving past what was then, I guess, Billboard Live, the Roxy, you know, the Whiskey, and I'm driving down, and it is deserted. There was nobody. Wow. And it was a Friday night, and I was like, it's all gone. Like, what's going on around here? And that was grunge, you know, and that was when it really hit home, that Friday night. I was like, this is dead down here. Like, and it used to be wall, like bands, flyers, you know, everybody trying
to. You didn't have to go inside the club. It was like a party on the street, really.
On the street all the way down, just packed with people flyering, come see our show, come see our show. Because every night in LA, it was like, you know, so many clubs with like four or five bands a night, and everybody wanted you to come see their band and stuff. It was just the place to go if you had a band to try and make it. And then I just sort of saw all that dissipate, like, with that was Nirvana, Soundgarden, and Alice in Chains and stuff just kind of taking over.
Yeah, to live that in real time was very interesting to watch.
It's crazy. Pete, was that the name you were looking for? Somebody just commented on there.
I'm taking Chrissy
Steele?
Chrissy Steele, it might have been. I think that might have been. Yeah, maybe.
Chrissy Steele was technically, I think she kind of replaced Darby Mills, if I'm not mistaken.
Vancouver.
Maybe it wasn't Chrissy Steele then.
Was she the singer of Wild Child?
She went on to be like a solo artist that Brian McLeod sort of produced.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Different one, I think.
We played the Rock and Roll Heaven, Age of Electric. Huh. This is a perfect example of the Age of Electric experience. We're playing our first time in Toronto at Rock and Roll Heaven. I don't know if you remember that place, but
I remember the name. I was never there.
It was a big rock place to play at. And it was Chrissy Steele, our opening, and they put us, you know how like you're like lit, like you've set up on this post, you can set up on this much of the stage, so you're like literally like on top of each other. And I remember where it's sound check, and as A&R guy, we were being courted by labels at the time, and he goes, oh, by the way, this is Alana, and I go, oh, hello, how are you? And then our drummer comes back and just starts cussing like a sailor, like, and there's this young girl like who they just introduced me to as this new artist. And he's just cursing because the drummer's not letting us set up on his drum on the riser. We got to set up on the thing. You know how it always was. You're always kind of, And he was just cursing like all the wrong things to say in front of young girls. I'm like, dude. And then it turned out her name was Alanis. I had heard it wrong. So she had a massive hit on the radio at the time. I was like, oh, you're Alanis. Okay. And I was just like, Kurt, shut up. You're teenage girls.
God, I've got from about the same time I got an Alanis story.
Oh yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Well, one of the very first calls I got for an audition in LA as a side guy was for Alanis, and the record hadn't even come out yet, so she didn't have the hit yet. But
the big record you're talking about.
Yeah, and I knew a few guys that had played on it, and maybe that's how I got the call, because I knew Matt Logg and Lance Morrison. Yeah, a few dudes that played on that album. And so somebody must have referred me. But anyways, I was trying to break into that world a little bit, as well as whatever else I could get going. And I remember they said, come down and drop off a package, which was probably a cassette tape and my playing, you know, and an 8x10 or something, you know, and whatever, at the management company, and, you know, drop it off with the manager or whatever, and you can meet him. And so I remember driving down to the management company, and I had something to do, you know, that I can't remember what, but I had somewhere to be, and I sat there for about 40 minutes and waiting in the lobby of this management company, and with this package and a manila envelope and my stuff. And eventually I got frustrated. I said, I gotta go. I'm just gonna leave this. And she's like, really? You don't want to meet him? It'll just be a few more minutes. I was like, I really gotta split. And I just left the envelope, you know. And then I was like, God, this guy's keeping me waiting. And like 2 months later, it was like, I'm here to remind you. And that was like for the next 3 years, that's the only song.
I know. We toured with we were touring with Sass Jordan, and her drummer was this young kid named Taylor Hawkins.
Right.
And the guitar player was Nick Lashley. And they awesome dudes, and we loved those guys. And then after that all kind of they I remember talking to Taylor, and he's like, yeah, we're gonna go play with this. Me and Nick are going to play with this Alanis girl from Canada. You might know her. I go, the pop singer? Because Alanis had a hit song in Canada, was kind of in the Debbie Gibson mode. And I was kind of like, that's really weird. I just couldn't make sense of it in my head. And the same thing. It's like, you know, 2 months later, I'm watching, you know, Much Music and MTV. And it's just like the biggest thing happening. And there's Taylor, who goes on to be a Foo Fighter, you know?
Yeah, it's like 18 million copies or 26 million copies or whatever she sold. And it was I remember that the gig was really low paying at the beginning, because I remember the guys were getting like, you know, $350 a week or something to start. Mm-hmm. I remember them asking Rob Ladd, who played on the album, you know, if he would go out and do it. And he said, I don't leave my driveway for like, you know, and then it blew up huge, you know, but you never know.
Yeah. Was Barry Squire still kind of conducting those, like assembling those sort of audition things back
in even know. This was pre me ever meeting Barry.
Oh, okay.
Although there was a woman named Meredith Brooks that was the first time that I met Barry Squire. I got into that. Actually, it was Rob Ladd who played drums in her band on the road, same Rob. And she was sort of doing an Alanis kind of trip and certainly influenced by her. And I got into that audition through Rob and Barry. That's how I met Barry, who's, if for those that don't know, he's like kind of an LA classic sort of, you know, he's a wonderful guy. Actually, we became good friends.
He's the best, yeah.
He had a big effect on my career. He's the Chris Cornell and Courtney Love and all kinds of people he introduced me to. But that's how I met Barry. Was I got pretty far in that audition process, and he's like, "Who's this guy?" Like, because I'd come in the back door through the drummer who referred me to get in for the audition.
Amazing. But
that was a few years after the Alanis thing. So
that's so awesome.
Yeah.
So basically, you end up in Hollywood, and then as a Canadian, the whole thing is now, how do I stay here for as long as possible, and then. Long story short, so you've been in Los Angeles for a long time.
Yeah. I mean, on and off. It was like I was kind of back and forth for those first few years after school and stuff, and we're writing songs at the band and stuff. But I officially got my work visa and record deal and all that stuff like in about 95. I had been working with a band writing and stuff, and we got a Japanese and Southeast Asia record deal in 95 and made the record in 96. And then I was like, okay, now I'm officially down here. And so that's what started, and it was kind of my okay, now I'm a professional musician, you know. And that went on.
It's a good feeling.
Yeah. So
you ever got your like O-1 visa, your official work visa in that band? Prior to that, it was just sort of bullshit, those visas that you got, like the student visa and all that.
Exactly, like student visa, and wasn't, you know, no official like music gigs or anything. Yeah. And but that Yeah. Sorry, say again, Shane.
Well, I just say, yeah, like it would expire like in 6 months or something. I went through all those different.
Well, I navigated that whole system even after that, because it was like, I think actually what I had initially was performer. Like when the band hired me, it was a P1 for a year. And that was like, okay, we've got, you know, a budget and we've got recording dates set in the studio. We've got everything sort of official that I need in order to get down there and work. So they got me the P1 visa to do all that stuff. And then I think I had for the next number of years, 7 consecutive P1, something like that. And then I went to the O1, 3 consecutive O1s into the, and for folks that don't know, I mean, that are out there, the Americans, it's a long, arduous bureaucratic process of like work. You know, I did a show last week dedicated to Eddie Van Halen, on my Sunday live stream that I do every week on my YouTube. And I mentioned that Eddie and we didn't think about this in the '80s that much. He was a biracial immigration story, like success story, the American dream, actually.
Yeah. Coming from America. Apparently.
Yeah, well, it's and first language was, you know, he grew up in, you know, Dutch. I mean, you know, right? And in Holland and with his mom from Indonesia. So anyways, then him moving to America, not being able to speak the language and immigration and all that. And I mentioned, you know, and this can be a hot, you know, you can get into politics and stuff, but it's like, it's more than just that, because no matter what, who's the president and what, you know, it's been a difficult, long bureaucratic trek, as you guys know, for many, many, many years. It's a difficult thing to actually work in the U.S. as a and do it legally. And we've all done it, but it's hard, and it needs that system could use some streamlining and some reform. And it's a difficult thing, but we made it work. So
what's your status now?
What's that?
What's your status now?
Yeah, I'm American now, actually. So I'm dual. Yeah, I'm dual citizen. But I became a, you know, I want to be able to vote where I live and be a part of the system and stuff like that. So eventually I became, because I live in, it's like, okay, going, once you're going on 20, 30 years, however long.
Yeah, you've lived in America longer than Canada. You have to kind of think that way. Yeah,
that's true.
That's really what it comes down to. Yeah.
I mean, I love Canada and I'll always be, you know, Canadian, course, but this is, I love both. It's weird. We grew up.
It's just one big country when you're dual citizen, right?
I don't think it's so weird. Yeah. It's like it's Canada and it's U.S. Basically, we're all the same humans occupying space.
Right?
You know? One side a little better at hockey than the other, and that's just, you know, the way it is.
Yeah,
I don't know about that. We've lost a couple of times now to the States.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we got
there's a lot of Canadian players in the U.S. We all know that. We all got that.
Yes, that's true.
But when was the last time a Canadian team won a friggin' Stanley Cup?
1993, Montreal.
Really?
Really?
93.
Is that right?
That's inexcusable.
Wow. Yeah,
it was the year that Toronto was on a run to basically make the finals, and it would have been a Toronto-Montreal Stanley Cup final. And wow. I mean, there's a lot of conspiracy theories on this, but I don't know if you guys remember, but it was when Wayne Gretzky had just come down to L.A. So it was L.A. and Toronto, and there was that infamous missed call. Kelly Frazier even wrote about it later, saying it's like one of the worst calls he didn't call. And it was when Gretzky clipped Gilmore, and he should have got 5 minutes for it, but didn't call, turned the other way. And anyways, L.A. went on to win, and therefore it was L.A. and Montreal in the finals that year.
Aaron, this is a missed opportunity. We should have a hockey show. It just, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
hockey Wednesday or something like that.
I'm
curious about something. I don't know if any of you guys know this, but if a player is on a Canadian team like Vancouver or Edmonton, do they get paid in U.S. dollars, or is it Canadian dollars?
All NHL players get paid in U.S. dollars, even if they're on a Canadian team.
All right. So they don't care if they're in the States or in Canada. It's all the same.
Think about it. It's hard enough to get a guy to come play for the Jets, and then you're going to say, oh, by the way, we're going to give you 50 cents on the dollar to do it.
That's incredible. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
So every Canadian team has like some sort of business organization set up in the U.S. in order to pay their players?
You know what? I don't know how they manage it. I mean, but yeah, it would have to be across the board, right? Because
it's a union thing, maybe.
Yeah, where do you want to play, buddy? You know? So, you're making 8 million U.S., I'm making 8 million Canadian, so, you know, half.
Yeah, exactly.
Fascinating. I don't know if you guys remember, but you're going to remember because you've obviously remember all the way back to the 90s, but a few years ago when Edmonton was in the playoffs and came that last game where, you know, what were they, like Edmonton was like up 7-3 or something, or what was it? Or no, it was 3-0, right? And then like, I don't watch a hell of a lot of hockey, I'll admit, but I was in it, I was determined to watch because Edmonton, Edmonton boy. And then they just in the last, the last 3 minutes, it was like, what happened? Like the world fell apart. And that was so depressing.
Toronto did that a couple years when the Bruins went on to win it. You know, they had the game and last couple minutes gave it away. And
it's not over till it's over. It's an amazing conversation when Gretzky came to Los Angeles. The end of that era. Because Edmonton, I mean, we used to go to those games too. My family was all from Edmonton, so we'd go back. I took for granted how many times I saw Gretzky, Kevin Lowe.
Me too, man.
Dude, like, it was just like normal to go to like games.
My dad had season tickets, and I saw that Dream Team. I mean, But I was at the game. I'm sorry, I interrupted you. I got passionate about it for a minute.
No, no, no. Yeah, yeah.
It's your show. That's how the show works. Whoever's loudest and whoever. Yeah.
I was at the game where they won without Gretzky. They won the cup the last time with. Yeah. And I remember Messier skating around with the cup, just like, we did it. You know, and the city went insane that night because they'd lost the previous year. Yeah. And then.
No, I mean, it did a lot for the game, though, right? I mean, the fact that Gretzky came to the States, it just opened up a whole world that exists now.
it's the biggest trade, right?
Up we can't keep a Stanley Cup in Canada since 1993. There you go.
Right.
Why does Gretzky have a problem having sex with Janet Jones?
Is this a joke or are you?
It's really a joke. It's a joke.
He's got a sex therapy show he's got going on.
It have something to do with eight.
Because he didn't have Curry to put it in for him.
That's a Yari Curry.
I have a question, and I wanted to find out about this because I never actually knew, Pete, how did you get in contact with Nagabuchi? Tsuyoshi Nagabuchi is this huge, iconic rock star, like icon, huge status in Japan. And Pete, you've played with him for a few tours, right?
Yeah. I mean, I started in 2014 and 2014, 15, 16. I mean, I even sat in on a gig like last year. So I still, you know, I like to think it's still going. I hope that's not the end because I love it so much, as I know you do over there. I fell in love with Japan in the 90s. The first time I went there, I don't know what it was, but I was like, this is like going to another awesome planet. That's so much fun. And I just really love Japan. So that when that opportunity came up through, it was, you know, a guy that's been really wonderful to me throughout my career and really instrumental in helping me get a few gigs is Brian Ray, who plays in Paul McCartney's band. And he gets a lot of calls because he's very well known for being, you know, pro for many, many years and playing with McCartney. So other folks will call him and say, hey, can you come do our tour? And he's just been wonderful saying, you know, like, well, I'm not available, but give my friend Pete a call. And so that's happened a few times. And that's originally how it came out. I would say that the other factor was YouTube, because they could go to YouTube and see, well, who's this guy he's referring us to, and then see the videos and go, oh, you know, and you know, it's kind of like you're auditioning without having to do anything other than the work you've already done. So it was those two factors. Yeah, a fellow named Dennis Martin, who I've become very good friends with, is an interesting cat. Actually, he's like a guy that lives, musician producer that lives in New York. Brooklyn guy, you would never dream in a million years that he knows, you know, speaks fluent Japanese and does a lot of business over there. And he became kind of 20 years ago a liaison between Japan and the U.S. and facilitating, you know, like I think his first gig was a Japanese artist hired him to organize an orchestra for a recording in New York City. And he became acquainted with some Japanese folks, business people and people in the music industry through that project, and just started going over there and working more and more, ended up producing records, meeting Tsuyoshi. And then Dennis was the guy that got in touch with Brian Ray and said, can you come do our tour? And Brian referred me. So
I think it's really cool because Shane, you know, I didn't even know that there was just really a thing, but the fact that they're like looking for Western American musicians is really such a cool thing. Like,
yeah.
You know, I mean, it's, that said, no one's calling me. No one. I never got to.
Well, it may happen.
You're too tall.
Yeah, I'm too tall, exactly.
It may happen once you realize that there's Italy, France. I mean, I've worked in France too for two different artists now. There's stars in these places that are, I mean, mega artists that sell out stadiums that we've never really heard of in Canada or the US, or maybe you've heard, oh yeah, that name. I mean, the biggest ones maybe Johnny Halliday in France, but in France, he's like the Elvis of France. He's the biggest artist of all time, and so there's gigs that come up with folks like that where they want to, and it was explained to me that they like. It's kind of a novelty, I guess, to hire American, you know, rock and roll. I don't know. It was like sort of, I guess, born in America and stuff. And there's also something to do with the attitude and the work ethic. Like in France, they told me a little bit about how like the musicians will sort of come into rehearsal and learn the songs in rehearsal, you know, and really tighten them up there. Whereas they were blown away with one of the artists I played with over there. They hired almost an all American band. We came in and set up the gear, got some sounds, and said, okay, what do you guys want to start with? Let's start with this tune. We played the song, and the crew people were like, they told me, you know, a couple months later, they were like, you guys like played it basically perfectly the first time, you know, you'd never played yet. We didn't even understand that. Cause usually they're not bagging on French musicians, some fantastic musicians, but it's a little more, maybe just, I don't know, lackadaisical or something. They'll come in and work on it in rehearsal and get the stuff.
That is funny though, isn't it? Because I know guys like everybody here would show up knowing the song. Like that's how we roll. We just kind of roll in like, and know the whole set kind of thing, you know,
tighten up the ending, maybe
sure. Yeah.
Dynamic things or whatever, but you basically come in, you've done your homework at home, right?
Totally. Yeah.
So,
yeah. Well, it's interesting. Yeah. Also getting back to Nagabuchi. So I mentioned in the preface to all this, I didn't know Pete back in the day. For all those years that we've been here, you know, in different circles and knew a lot of the same people, but I never actually, I don't know if I was in Japan so much over the course of the last, you know, 18 years or whatever, but we never met until Japan.
I'd heard your name so many times too. Yeah. I mean, going all the way back to when you first were going down to the States. I remember, I think it was probably my friend Al, mutual friend Al Vermeer, you know, that. Yeah. And I'd heard about you were playing with Yngwie and, you know, way back.
It was funny in the course. So we had dinner together one night. It was your birthday that night. And I met Dennis and I ended up getting a gig through Dennis, like the next day. What this artist, so actually Tsuyoshi's kid, Wataru is his name.
Yeah.
He's kind of a reggae rap artist, and we ended up doing that session, yeah, that reggae sort of session.
Yeah, and I played on that track. I think that track's out now.
So yeah.
It did come out,
I don't know, like earlier this year, so it's kind of funny how it's a small world.
It
is funny though, but I mean, I think you probably had that experience too when you come to the States and you meet somebody who's from like around your area, but you never knew them back home. It's such a funny thing how small the world is, and yet how increasingly huge it is at the same time.
Yeah. So, yeah. Well, I mean, just the fact that I reconnected with, like, after seeing, you know, Utah, like playing with Age of Electric, like I say, back when I was a little kid, basically, you know, and I remember you, and then years later, you know, end up, you know, oh, now I'm here, I'm getting jamming with you, you know, doing two gigs.
I know, right? We got to talk about that too, because there's this footage I just put up online today, and it was like this random show where Dauphin Country Fest. Corey was doing Shania, and I guess Shane was in Japan. So we had Pete Thorne on lead guitar, and then we brought in Zach Throne, our dear friend, on bass. So it was a really fun night because we did prepare a giant chunk of the set, but there was a certain amount of like Rocking in the Free World by Neil Young and Taking Care of Business by BTL, like a lot of like just jamming. And I kind of watched a bit of it because I, you know, because you prepare, but then stuff like that, I was like watching you tear it up in like Taking Care of Business, which I don't think we even rehearsed. I think it was just kind of like, it's in C, right? And it's just so much room for you just to kind of like, solo, go crazy. And it was great, man. It was really fun. We had a really good time.
I had so much fun, Jamie.
I can't say too much because those two guys are here. So
it's so much better than the other lineup.
Well, it's funny because when I think of the band now, I think of the band as with Brent on drums, and I've always thought, I've never played, I don't think of Brent as a bass player, which isn't fair because I know he's a good bass player, you know, but I don't think about him that way because I used, you know, Brent and I actually a little bit in the early 90s did some cover gigs together. Just some one-off kind of stuff. So I always thought of him as the drummer, you know, and it's like, and that's what we did in Winnipeg that, you know, a few years ago.
Exactly, and
so, it's funny. So I'd love to jam again and have him on bass. Just be like, you know, wow, you know, he's such a great musician.
Yeah. It was a fun night. I remember you being like, you know, I remember you doing like some, your YouTube stuff, playing like the solo for Saga and stuff like that.
There's a picture, you know, from Dauphin Country Fest that year.
I'm concentrating. How the hell is this song? Because it was like 23 songs I had to learn. I'm like, what? How's the bridge go again? Corey, it's big shoes.
Did you learn all those solos too, Pete, just for that one gig?
Oh, yeah. You got to, you know?
Yeah,
you got to play
this. He did a YouTube thing about like playing.
Didn't
like
you hear him just say about having to learn the stuff before you show up, you know?
It's a lot of work.
was a lot of work. There's a lot of guitar parts in that stuff. Like,
oh man, it was a lot. Corey was very, very helpful, like sending me even the sounds you use and stuff, and any questions I had. So it was great. I had so much fun. I mean, honestly, it was like, it was all about the fun. That gig was really fun. I mean, I remember like the people kind of filtering in and out from that, because we were playing out in the sort of the, what would you call it? It's an outdoor venue, but the foyer or whatever.
I totally forgot about that, because we started playing and it was kind of like Darren, you might be able to help me with this. Wasn't there like another concert happening that was letting out and they were kind of filtering past us?
Well, they have the big stage where like the main acts were playing that year. So,
who,
you know,
was
like
playing?
Well, here's the funny thing. It was actually the night before you guys were there, Streetheart was on. That was one of, if not Kenny's second last show. I remember right after that, because I kicked myself, we didn't go out the night before. And then I think they did one more in Edmonton, and then that was the last. But I know that year was also, I think it was Big and Rich. They had, I actually think... Yeah, it was Country Fest, right? So they always have whatever's going on. I can't remember, years kind of blend into the other years. But yeah, the big stage was there. And then, of course, you guys were on the, what they call the B stage, but which turned out to be the...
You know why it's called the B stage? The best stage. It's the best stage.
Yeah. That's right. Well, you certainly made that happen. I mean, God.
No, it was so funny, because like we started our set and it was like, you know, people were there. And then as it by the end of the like, third, fourth song, it was suddenly like a rock concert. Like,
it was
boom.
Jam, man.
Yeah, it was a great time.
Commanding as hell. I mean, it was just like people heard those tunes and your voice and stuff, and that was it.
Oh, well, thank you.
It was a party. It was so much fun.
No, Karen, you can continue talking about me. That's great.
Oh, dude, you blew me away. Honestly, your voice. Dude, I mean, I remember when you were singing like the Darby stuff and whatnot. That was like,
oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, I remember looking at Zach going, how the fuck is he doing that? How is that coming out of that guy? Like, how can he sing like that?
It was amazing. It just means the next 2 days there'll be no talking. That's all.
No way.
But yeah, no, that was a really fun. Was it just the one show or was there two shows we did?
I think it was just the one that time.
Just the one. Yeah, well, you guys were up here for a string of shows, but I think after that show, Zach went back, and Corey and Shane were back, because then I think we did Harbor Fest and a couple of Winnipeg shows.
You know what it was like? It was like that season of the Dukes of Hazzard, where there was just two other dudes for that whole season.
What year was it?
The year of the Dukes of Hazzard, or the years of the two shows?
It was like Cousin Cody or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. So
it was Canada Day of 2017.
Right.
Hey, I don't know that I did any of that leg. I think I would have been gone.
I think maybe Fitz might have played drums. Maybe Zach's.
Oh, you know, you're right. No, you know why? Because Spider came on to do some of those shows.
Okay. Yeah.
Spider,
that's right.
Yeah. Spider and Loverboy. Talk about. We got to talk about Chris Cornell, because this is a constant fascination. We talked about him a lot when you were out with us. Well, we talk about him all the time, but. Yeah. What an amazing, I mean, on top of everything else you've done, I mean, we can go on about like almost everybody you play with, but Chris was, I mean, the fact that Chris is gone, it, like anybody now, like with Ed, or it's when they're gone and suddenly the myth just, you know, just, or the legend just grows so much. And Chris, as beloved as he was, even while he was with us, he takes on a whole other level of stuff now. And so the fact that you know the man and you play with the man on a day-to-day basis and hung out with him. If by all intents and purposes, by every story I hear, he was just an amazing dude just a pro to the end, from what I understand.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Well, I mean, he was a wonderful guy. He was really funny and had this great sense of humor. He was really curious, always learning and always wanting to, you know, try new things musically and learn. And you know, I mean, I felt like he was really honestly one of my best friends. Like, I just cherished the time I got to talk with him and just be, I don't know. He was a guy that you could call up and bounce things off of. Like, you know how not every boss is like that you work for, you know, you go on to keep it, you know, but he was like, for some reason, I guess it's because he was a band guy originally. So he grew up in bands. He wasn't like a solo artist originally. So it was all about connection and friends. And
did he not play guitar during your guys' run? He was basically just fronting, kind of thing.
Yeah, he enjoyed that, not playing guitar. He would play acoustic, though, and do like four or five songs in the middle. And then generally, I can remember we would usually come back from his acoustic portion of the show and play Doesn't Remind Me by Audioslave. And sure. He would start on acoustic on that, you know, and right. So then he would be playing acoustic with us. But that might have been the only tune.
The cool thing for a guy like you, and I think this says a lot about Pete Thorne, the guitar player, is that when you show up to do a gig like that, I can only imagine how much you must have been like, okay, this is for this song, the Tom Morello, because Tom Morello is one of those guys. It's like, you kind of have to have the stuff to play those parts and whatnot. But then the Kim Thayil yeah. stuff. So I'm assuming when you show up, you've got like, you've mapped out all these different sounds, all these different tones. And that's one of the things that's, you know, really sort of sets you apart from so many other people is your ability to kind of find those tones. I can't do that.
Well, I love it. I always have. So I guess it's going way back to, and it, you know what it is, man, it's really going back to those days in Canada where my formative years and learning, going to see your band and going to see Click and all these great bands, they nailed that stuff. And, you know, Al, he was one of my earliest, and I would ask him questions and he would be nice enough to, you know, let a kid that was 16 years old sneaking into the clubs to see him in on some of the secrets of what he was doing. I mean, he was literally like, he would show me, you know, oh, this is this type of effect, or, you know, I use a Marshall cabinet with Greenback 25s in the top and 30s in the bottom, and I'm doing this, you know, stereo rig, wow. a wet rig. I mean, he would show me all this stuff, and his guitar sound was always great. I was always into the sounds, and it was like in Canada in those days, in those cover bands, that sets you up for being a sideman later on, because you had to nail the tones and the parts, yeah. right? I mean, in all those bands, it was like, you know, it was, you weren't nothing if you couldn't nail, you know, when you play Led Zeppelin, it had to have the feel and the sound and the, I mean, when I think about the extent, you know, that some of the bands went to up there to get the sounds, the parts, even the look. I mean, it was like, there was guy, what's his name, that did
Guy Jones.
Yeah, the Alice Cooper tribute, right? You know,
Guy Jones, yeah.
You know, the dude driving around in a, you know, in a limo or whatever with like the snake, and he had all the stuff, the props, and it was like the yeah. cover bands were intense, like in Canada. Yeah, yeah. And no so joke. The attention to detail was so I learned that from back then, and then I used that and applied it later on for sure to now someone like Chris. He did really like that, but he also gave you a little leeway to do your own thing. So on something like Audioslave, I would cop the tremolo of Like a Stone on the verse and try and nail it. And then in the solo, I had the whammy pedal and did it right and all that stuff. And then in other songs where it was a less distinct sort of or important guitar part, you could take your own. And the beauty of Chris was actually he would hire people based on their skill and what they brought to the party. And then he wouldn't micromanage. He was a great boss in that way. He let us kind of do our thing. I was sort of, I guess, the MD. There was no MD of that band, but he would come to me to say, I want to learn this song and this song and this song, you know, can you get it to the guys? And I would distribute sure. email and stuff and do that. So although we didn't have everybody was on equal footing in that band, he would rely on me for that kind of organizational stuff. And then beyond that, if he wanted something different from me or one of the other players in the band, he would ask for it very directly. Don't do, you know, that guitar part like that. Can you do it a little more like, and that would be it. And you wouldn't hear anything for another 2 weeks about anything. He let you do your thing as long he was, you know, how a good boss like hires competent people and then doesn't try sure. and manage and wear themselves out. He just let us. And that, once again, I think that's a reflection of him being a band guy and being in a band and recognizing that people bring their things to the party. Totally. And it's the chemistry. So all that was great about him, but I can't say enough about, I don't know. He just, man, I learned so many. I don't even know where to start. I learned so many things from him, just about how to have a good time and be confident on stage, and how to, playing that music, man. I mean, it was the most closest to, it's not my songs. I didn't write those songs, you know, but it was, as far as playing rock music with a band on stage, that was the time of my life, you know.
I bet.
Yeah. Playing that music.
What a band, though. Great band.
Yeah. Oh, so much. Yeah. When we were a band, I mean, we did over 300 shows, and we became like, you know, we fought like a band, we hung like a band, we did everything like a band. And he even said that, he goes, I'm still in a band. I get on stage every night and I play in a band with these guys.
Yeah, that's totally true. Yeah. That's
so cool. I felt he needed a band that could translate everything from the Euphoria Morning through to his later solo albums, early Soundgarden, Temple of the Dog, Audioslave, and could do it all And so that was at one point, I looked a little while ago, and we had about 110 songs that we'd learned from his career. Yeah,
It's a hell of a catalog. Not just one thing. It covers so many different things. It's amazing.
And you guys were a hell of a band. I mean, I know everyone, all the members in the band, and those are the guys, you know, you want to have in your fucking band, period.
100%. Thanks, man. Yeah, I mean, it was a really great band, great chemistry, and great, like Yogi, for instance, was a very different guitar player than me. Totally. You know, he was like the wild card Jimi Hendrix kind of, he's a great improviser, blues improviser. And then I was a little bit more like the sounds and parts guy, the specific Tom Morello, this or, you know, certain things. If it, you know, the rotary on Black Hole Sun, I would cover all that stuff. And it was a little more like that. And that delineation worked because maybe two wild Hendrix like players wouldn't work in the same band.
Right.
Corey McCormick, having that guy, you know.
Oh, yeah. He's with Neil Young now. He's fantastic. He's
such a great player, great singer, great dude.
Yeah, and like just he plays great guitar. I mean, he's a really schooled musician, sweet guy, kind of understated guy. Yet he'd get on stage and just rock. He was like probably the most energetic.
Plays jazz, like stand up bass, just kills through standards and whatever you throw at him. But he'd strap on a five string and throw it down low and rock.
And maybe the deepest understanding of Soundgarden music when we started was Corey. He had been a real hardcore fan from, you know, so from the early days. I knew Soundgarden music and I loved Chris and stuff, but not like Corey did, you know. I didn't know the depth of it like Corey did. So Corey, like, you know, for instance, 4th of July, I'd never played that song and learned it. And one time Chris just started singing it on stage in randomly on a jam that we kind of like have these random moments on stage. I remember being in Argentina, it's like 25,000 people at this festival, you know, and him starting to sing the lyrics 4th of July. Corey just went to it. Wow. We never played it and he just from memory just kind of knew the song, you know, and then we just sort of followed along and made some noise, you know, and tried to stay out of the way. We did our own version of it, but you know, that was the kind of Corey had that deep understanding of all that.
That's amazing. Yeah. You know, it's a really interesting conversation because we've been talking about, and I'd love to move into talking about Ed if we have a moment to do so. Yeah. But one of the most interesting things that we talk about when we're talking about nailing tones and nailing parts, as guys who grew up watching cover bands going like, that guy's playing this solo exactly the way it is on the record or his guitar tone. The interesting thing about Van Halen is they started as a cover band like everybody else, but every single song that they played sound like Van Halen. You know, it's like when you hear You Really Got Me, you go, this doesn't really sound anything like, I mean, it has all the same parts, you know what I'm saying? But they made it their own song to the point that it's, you know, arguably their song in their own way. So Dancing in the Streets and Pretty Woman and You're No Good. I mean, it's a cavalcade of cover songs that don't really, in a lot of ways, like You're No Good, like that song is almost unrecognizable to the original. I mean, it's recognizable, but I think it's really interesting. It's an interesting conversation to be like, you know, with Took, it's like we're like curators of a time and a place in music about like making sure we have Corey's call, you know, sending over things going, is this the right keyboard patch? And I go, I don't know. But then I'm thinking to myself, when Van Halen, it seemed like, you know, what they talk about something like Dancing in the Streets or something like that. Well, we're just going to do it the way we play it. Like, we don't have all the instrumentation. We're Van Halen. We're just going to play it. And then I guess you've got Dave in there with the balls enough to just go, I'm going to sing this song and sell it. I mean, it's such an interesting thing that we don't really talk a lot about how Van Halen's sound was so identifiable that it was prevalent even in songs that they didn't write.
You know what I mean? Really interesting, man. It's a great point. And, you know, I think for guys like us, we're geeks at the core. So I know Corey gets like, how do I get that guitar tone? Right. And it's like, get like really into it. And I love that. I love from a hobbyist perspective, it's like really fun, but you're absolutely right. Then there's the folks like, I mean, when you think about, you know, Tainted Love, right. It was that band Soft Cell. I didn't even know that cover of a, you know, that's true. No idea in the way that they interpreted that. And you know what other band was great at it? Van Halen was definitely great at it. The Beatles were great at it. Like the way the Beatles interpreted music. And I always say the Beatles and Van Halen, the one thing they had in common, great, you know, great singers, great vocals and great cover bands before they hit it big. They played a lot. They played five sets a night or whatever, you know, and went out and just sang and didn't need a good PA, didn't need whatever. They just played. And it's a really interesting thing. I love listening to old Van Halen and Beatles, but early recordings of, you know, kind of bootleg stuff or club stuff and hearing how they interpreted the you know, everything from like, you know, Kool and the Gang or something, or ZZ Top, you know, or and all that ended up in Ed's playing and writing, that's for sure.
I think when you say interpreted, I think that's the best word for it. It's not like they were doing a note for note rendition of Kool and the Gang. They were doing their thing, you know.
It's funny, it was like later I would hear the original version, I'd be like, what's that? That's and it was just so the paradigm was so altered, I just couldn't get it, you know. It was like so odd, and like dance in the streets, or even You Really Got Me. I mean, it's basically Kinks are a rock and roll band, but it was just like, really? That's
at the time really that Kinks song must have been badass, you know what I mean? Like gang 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 gang.
But I think that's pretty much what you guys are doing, similar to what Took is, right? You're introducing music that people around the globe have not been introduced to, and
that's the intention.
What is new? I mean, as a kid, the same thing. I mean, you're growing up listening to songs you don't even know are covers until later in life, right? I mean, and it's they're kind of doing the same thing.
Yeah, you had a great service, you know, by reintroducing this terrific music to, you know. I mean, I even think about that. There's a great video on YouTube of Van Halen playing around 93 in the studio doing Won't Get Fooled Again with Sammy.
Really?
And it's awesome. They're in the studio. They're on headphones and stuff. It's great. Check it out. Like, and Eddie does the whole you know, the keyboard part on guitar. And it's awesome.
Of course,
The way he interprets other people's music is really cool. He had a hell of a set of ears for, you know.
You know, I wonder if, because I saw an Eddie, like, YouTube thing where some guy was just random dude was in there filming all the, like, he has walls and, like, just shelvings full of tapes.
Of tape.
Like, just jams that they just got shelved. I wonder, you know, what becomes of all that stuff, because there's got to be a ton of great music there.
I read an article the other day. I think it was Alex and Wolfgang are going through all of that, and that was kind of where they just left it. So, I mean,
wow.
I'm sure there's probably going to... Yeah, exactly.
It's you spend time at 5150, yes? The studio.
And the thing that you just mentioned, as much as I was struck by many things up there, the tape on the wall was one of the most striking things. Like, my God, look at all those reels of 24-track reels, you know? What's on all those reels, you know?
It's almost Paisley Park thing, you know, where you're thinking, like, Prince has all that stuff in the vaults, and you're like, okay, well, how much Van Halen stuff is releasable or we've never heard before, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, honestly, but he did play me. I mean, some of the most magic times of the last 20 years I can remember being up there and him going, check this out, and putting on a song, you know. And it wasn't like with no vocals, or it was like a song that had background vocals that he and Wolf had written and were jamming with Al. But it was stuff they were sending to Dave to see if he was interested, I think, you know.
Wow.
And I remember one tune in particular that he played me. I was like, this is fucking awesome, like, this is so cool. And him putting it on, how proud he was of it, and going, yeah man, check out this one, putting it on, he's like, the drums come in, he's like aping the drums, going like this, like air drumming, and then he's like, and then he goes, now check out the solo, he goes, I just wanted to milk it, play really slow, and he like does this one note, and he's going like this and playing air guitar, you know, and he hit a note and held it for like four bars, and he was just like milking this note, and that's how the solo started, you know. And I was like, is this happening? I was like, this is like the coolest thing ever. You know? But yeah, so I'd heard that and a couple other things. The other thing he would play me times was like them. They would jam and record a lot up there. So like it was the old tunes, but he's like, yeah, we did this morning. Check this out. And he'd have a reel up of them jamming that morning of like old tunes, you know, for getting ready.
Wow.
And I'd just be sitting there listening. It sounded like an album coming out of the speakers up there. It was incredible.
That's so cool. I mean, it's really cool to hear that he was still such a fan of music and of just creating and playing guitar. Like, he still seemed to love it right to the end.
He really did. And he gets, you know, people give him a lot of grief over the years. And he, you know, folks don't know, you know, he was dealing, well, it's not uncommon knowledge that he was going through health struggles for a long time and fighting you know, hard. But I really believe he was just trying to get back to being healthy and make more music. He loved it. He lived and breathed it. I'll tell you about one of the coolest days I ever went up there. I drove up there. It was a day that I brought him a phaser pedal for Christmas. So I said, I got something for you for Christmas, you know, and I got him this phaser from it was kind of a boutique pedal, like we were talking about earlier. And I had it engraved on the back, you know, for Christmas, you know, whatever year it was, 2010, 2009, whenever it was, Eddie Van Halen for Pete Thornton, you know, I brought it to him and I drove up to 15150. And when I got out of the car, there was blaring guitar coming out of the studio, and that had never happened before. So it's just like ripping loud coming out of the door. You know, you go up to this place and it's the front of the studio was painted like his guitar, the red and white stripes, like behind you, you know. And so the whole driveway has the stripes on it. It's just awesome. It's like, you know, so cool. If you're a Van Halen nut, you know, it's just like this is like going to church. So you get out of the car, I go walking up the door, and he's standing there in the doorway. And I remember he was wearing his bathrobe and slippers. And he's playing guitar in front of me, just standing there. And he's playing guitar, you know, this far away as I am from the camera, in his bathrobe. And he's playing. He looks at me and nods, and he doesn't stop playing. And he kept playing. He was playing a White Wolfgang guitar. Cool. He had his amp mic'd in the other room. It was coming to the big mains in 5150, and it was ripping loud coming through there. And he stood in front of me and played for about 10 minutes and just didn't stop. And I was just like, he's right there, you know. And then he sounded great. And he leaned over to me at one point and he said, like, do you ever do this? Do you ever slide harmonics? And he did something where he hit a harmonic and he slid the pitch on top of the string. And it was like the pitch changed. I was like, no, I've never done that. what? You know, and the other thing he had on that guitar was a Drop to Hell tailpiece, which was this thing he developed in one of the patents he held, I think. It didn't have a whammy bar on it, that guitar. It had this Drop to Hell thing. And it basically what it did was on the low E string, you could go between any two pitches with this lever. So you think, okay, kind of like his D tuner where you could go from E to D, or you could go from D down to B. Or something like that, right? And it was on a lever. And you think, okay, well, that's useful for like changing keys in a song. No, he had written with this thing in the same way he did the flip-up table guitar in 1984 tour and played it like a piano, or all the other innovative stuff that he did. He had, like, so he'd be like, you know, I don't remember but he had a song. It was like, and he's working the lever, playing this riff that he'd written with it. And I was like, fuck, he's still that guy. He is that guy. He's still doing it. He's still innovating. And like, and I remember just, God, that day, that might've been the same day he played me the music that I was mentioning earlier. And I gave him this pedal. And I remember he goes, oh man, I gotta give you something. And he goes in the other room and he brings me back a wah pedal. So he gave me an EVH wah that day. And then he goes, wait, you want some shoes too? Like, what size are you? And he goes and gets
my robe,
the Converse, and gives me a, you know, set of size 10 Converse that I still have to this day. And I end up leaving with this stuff. And he was so sweet, you know, and we listened to music and hung out for an hour and a half or whatever. And I got in my car and I drove away. And he'd always give you a big hug and a big kiss. He'd kiss you on the cheek, you know, give you a big hug. Always, you know, and I drove off down the hill just like, oh, like,
wow, that was a gift.
Like, what the hell just happened?
I mean, you can tell the way I talk about it. It's just like, I just felt like it was the biggest gift, you know, I was so inspired when I left. Like, oh, people have to hear that music he played me, and people have to see the thing and how he used it. I remember saying to him about the Drop to Hell tailpiece, like saying, like, is that coming out? Like, and he's like, ah, people don't understand what it is. Like, how? And I go, well, all you got to do is just show them what you just showed me. They're going to freak. It's like when he popularized the Floyd Rose or whatever, you know, like the way you're using it is like people are going to get it. And I just felt like people got to see this stuff. And it's amazing. I just, like, my 14-year-old was in her 14-year-old on fire.
That's the thing, though, dude, is it's like you're literally a kid growing up on that music. And then you're like in his presence and you're watching basically a concert that was just presented just for you. Like, he's just like,
doesn't happen. I don't know how to describe it. It's like the fact that you know how you guys know, because you made the journey to all of a sudden you're on stage playing festivals of Slash and you're in front of all these people and stuff. And you're like, I think I've arrived, like, at where I wanted to be. Like, it's happening. Or, you know, Shane, some of those pictures you put up of playing with, you know, the artist you play with over in Japan is a stadium level, you know, you're just like, well, I think this is it. Like, I think I'm here. Like, you know, I'm where, and the Eddie Van Halen, meeting him and just being in that presence was like, I don't know what beyond this, like, where do I, who do I want to meet beyond, you know, I guess there's always more, but I just felt like this was my dude, like, you know.
Yeah.
How was it that you got to know him?
Well, that's a crazy story. It was through Dave Friedman. And
Friedman Amplifiers.
Yeah, Friedman Amplifiers. And it was really through Chris Cornell, to be honest, because
okay.
I told the story a little bit. I don't want to bogart all the time and stuff. And take.
No, but, it's your time, baby. It's your time. Go.
How are you?
Well, okay. So it was 2009 or eight or nine. I can't remember. And Chris had come out with the Scream album, which was an album that was kind of a unique album. It was done by Timbaland, and it was almost like a hip hop album, really, which was really different for him. And he wanted to try doing a couple songs off the record in a production, like, because, you know, a good song is a good song is a good song. You produce it 100 different ways. So he had this idea to produce up a few that were really stripped down and do a couple of them that way. Maybe release them. Maybe just try it. See what it sounded like. So I produced up two versions of songs from the Scream album. And I played acoustic guitar. I had John Button play upright bass and Thomas Panos play drums. And kind of brushes, mellow, sort of almost singer-songwriter, mellow style. And I played them for Chris, and he really was digging it. He's like, oh, man, this is great. And I didn't really know, but he had been hanging out with Eddie Van Halen since back in the 90s. He was friends with them back in the day, and they had hung out, you know, had some wild party times together, I think, stuff like Lost Weekend stuff. Chris described it like, you know, he'd show up in his car and go, get in the car, and he'd go, dude, I got stuff to do today. Just get in. And then he goes, I'd be gone for like 3 days or 4 days. Those kinds of stories. And Chris, Eddie always really loved Chris's vocals, of course, and singing. And I think he wanted to do something with them, like, you know, and I think Chris was like, I'm not joining Van Halen. Like, you know, that's not what it, but I think they both wanted to do something. They were friends. And at some point that was kind of, you know, and Chris, he had said, I always remember his piano playing was what really struck him. You see him sit at a piano and just play. It's unbelievable. Wow. You know, Ed playing piano, just incredible. Yeah. And I'd heard that piano was his first instrument. So anyway, Chris heard these tunes and that I produced up for him. And he said, he looked at me and he goes, we're sitting in the car, really across the street from where I am right now. And he was sitting in the car looking at me going, what do you think we got Eddie Van Halen to play on this? I'd never met Ed at this point or anything like that. And it was like, are you serious? Like, I was like, dude, yes. You know, like, can you make that happen? And he's like, well, he's wanted to do something with me. And, you know, and I think this would be a good, what if we got him to play piano? It'd be really beautiful on this. And I was like, dude, come on, let's do this. So you guys know how it is sometimes working with artists. They can come up with ideas. They get a lot of, they're artists. They come up with creative ideas and stuff, and then it can kind of go in one ear and out the other, or whatever, or the creative thing, and it doesn't necessarily materialize. Mm-hmm. So 3 weeks go by, a month go by, maybe brought it up once or twice. Like, hey, did you, you know, I didn't want to bug him. He's my boss, but I was like, hey, did you talk to Ed, you know, about the, oh, no, I'll do that. I'll get, and he never did, you know. And furthermore, he was a little bit, this is part of the story, he was a little bit hard to reach all of a sudden, which also happened. Like, he traveled a lot. He had a home in Paris, you know, he went to Greece, he like was all over the place. So he wasn't around. One day I go in Dave Friedman's shop. Dave did all of Eddie's rack work, amp repair, all that kind of stuff. And Dave just mentions offhand, oh, I got to go up right now and go up to Ed Van Halen's place and do some work on his rack or something. And I was like, light bulb, you know, I was like, can you please do me a favor and just mention to him that Chris Cornell is interested in him working on a track or a couple tracks, you know, and see what he says. Dave's like, okay. And so I got a text. Dave left and I got a text about 45 minutes later. Ed wants you to give him a call.
Dude, that's crazy.
That's how it happened. And wow. So he sent me his phone number and, want to hear the rest?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so what happened next? So I put his number in my phone. And I always remember I put his number in my phone, Eddie Van Halen with a picture from 1984 where he's got the No Bozos shirt on and the white Kramer. And I also put a custom ringtone in my phone that was the beginning of Eruption. Right? So I did that eventually. But I actually had my phone on silent. I left him a message, which I was nervous.
Eddie.
Yeah, I was nervous, you know. Yeah, it's Pete Thorne. I play with Chris Cornell. I just got your number from Dave Friedman, and yeah, I was giving you a call. okay, bye. You know, whatever. So it was the next day or the day after. I was telling a story the other day on my live stream, but I was, or yeah, and I was in the John when he called. That's exactly what happened. You can hear the phone vibrating. I had my phone on vibrate. I remember it was on the kitchen table, and the and you're like missing a call, you know, because you're in the John or whatever. And I remember going out looking at the phone, missed call, Eddie Van Halen. Anyway, I called him back and we did talk, which was awesome. And he was like, well, how soon can you come up and play me the song or whatever? And I was like, dude, I'm in Studio City. I lived in Studio City. You know, so I'm right down the hill. Like, I knew where he lived. You know? And so we worked it out eventually. And a few days later, it got postponed a couple times. But eventually, I ended up going up there. And I want to tell you the whole story. Right? I won't tell you the whole story right now because I want to make a separate video about it at some point. But I ended up going up there and that very, I always thought I would meet him, but I didn't think it would be under the guise. I thought it would be a handshake and me saying, thank you so much. Like, you're my biggest guitar inspiration or something like that. I didn't think I'd be going up there to bring a track up to play him to potentially work on something. Right.
Wow.
And so I find myself within, the whole story is quite funny of what happened in the first half an hour that I got there. And it was very disarming and sweet. And, you know, I'll tell that later. But anyways, he ends up taking me up to the studio and walking me through and giving me the tour of the studio and saying, you know, this is where we've done everything since the album 1984. That's the album with Jump on it. He said,
like, you don't know. You know.
I know. Yeah, he didn't know. Like, if I was, he didn't know me from Adam, right? So, right. But I remember all that. I remember seeing Al's drums. I remember seeing all that tape on the wall and just being blown away. And then I'm sitting at the console, and this is long enough ago that I brought it up on CD. So I give him a CD, and he puts the song in that I've been working on with Chris. And he starts playing it, and it's coming through the mains, and it's me playing guitar, which is weird because I'm sitting there beside him, and it's my guitar parts. And I'm just like, this is so surreal. And he says to me, okay, I'm going to listen, and then you tell me what you want me to do.
Wow.
Dude.
Wow. Not computing in my head. Like, what? Like, you know, and he listened to the whole track, and I just remember him going, oh, yeah, I could hear all kinds of stuff on. This is wide open. Like, and I was like, exactly. You can do whatever you want, and I'm going to be okay with it. So the one thing I have to say here is 100%, you know, I don't want blabbermouth or something like it, an unreleased track with Chris Cornell and Eddie Van Halen, because long story short, he did work on it, and I worked on it with him that week, and I would go up and listen and stuff, and he would call me and go, I just got an idea. I did like some tapping on it, like Women in Love in the beginning, the clean tapping, you know, and I was like, oh, God, this is so cool. Like, I'm on the phone, he's telling me this stuff. I drove up.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and he goes, come up and listen to it. It's really cool. And he played it for me, and I was like, that's okay. That's me and Ed Van Halen, and we're on a track together. Like, what is happening? Like, on a 24 track reel is what he was doing it on. You know, more on that in just a second, because I want to definitely say that Chris never ended up singing on it. So that's really
cool. Oh, wow.
That it never happened. That because I was mentioning earlier how artists do things and then they kind of they get an idea and then they disappear.
Yeah.
I said to Eddie after that day hearing it, I said, I think before we do anything else, I should probably get a scratch vocal on this. You can hear the melody and stuff because there was no vocal on it yet. And you can hear what's happening. And he's like, yeah, that'd be great. That'd be great. And so then I tried to contact Chris, and Chris went off the map. It was one of those times where I just for the next month, I couldn't get in touch with him. And I was like, Ed's actually worked on it. And it's like, is there any way I can get you to just sing a scratch? No response.
So he didn't even know you were over there.
Well, I don't know if he ever, it was one of these things where, man, he just went off the map. And that happened a few times throughout our, you know, sure. I guess I knew him for 12 years or 13, 14 years. And there'd be times where I just 6 months would go by where you don't hear from him.
Yeah.
He's really mysterious that way. You know, I don't know what he was doing or whether, and I didn't want to push it or whether he was mad at me because I'd made the connection and gone over there. I don't know what the deal was. A couple of years after this, he contacted me. He goes, hey, you know that version of Scream you were working on? Can I get that? Because I want to, he ended up doing this, the songbook tour, one of his first acoustic tours where he was acoustic solo. And he went out and set up the stage like a living room. And he had a turntable on the stage and he had a bunch of stuff put on vinyl so he could put a record on and drop the needle and jam along like he was in his living room. It was really cool. And that was one of the things that he played to was that track.
Mm.
And so he did end up using it, but I was just in the back of my mind. I was like, great if you'd done that. Like, you know, if 2 years ago, when Eddie Van Halen was working on it, so that wasn't the version that he you know.
Right.
It just never came to fruition. Ed got busy doing stuff after a month or, you know, working on Van Halen and stuff. And we just said, let's just put it to bed, because I told him I can't get in touch with Chris. And then we just became friends and hung out after that. And that was it.
That's so cool.
But there was that moment where I went up there and heard the real playing with the stuff coming out of the sound coming out of the speakers. It was like, oh my God, I can't believe this. This is so crazy.
Well,
that is awesome. Yeah.
So that's a story. Did he ever Jay Friedman for that day too? Cause that never would have happened without my friend.
That's amazing.
And Chris, you know, for having the idea. Course, but anyway.
Yeah.
So awesome. Ramming with legends.
Yeah.
Yeah. I ended up, over the years, like, I would collaborate fairly closely with him. I did videos for his pedals. So, you know, like his 5150 overdrive, the chorus pedal. And we were in close contact about that stuff too. So we worked on some more stuff together where I would take the videos that I make for pedals and stuff. I just kind of, my deal is what I do is what I do. And I'm just going to put it out if you want me to do it. And that's kind of like creative control, but yeah, not with him. With him, it was like, can you show it to me first? Of course. And anything you want me to change, I'll change.
Yeah, of course.
I never want to put something out there that you're unhappy with. That's got, so I would, you know, go up there and show them the videos and stuff and work. And it was just really, I don't know, it was fun. I mean,
that's so cool. I mean, it's amazing because as this, you know, since Ed's passing, getting these kind of stories, this is, your story is actually one of the most, like, intense in its own way kind of stories to me. Because I've heard a lot of different people's accounts of Eddie Van Halen, but yours sounds like the most, like you went to Willy Wonka's chocolate factory and had like the full experience. You know what I mean? Like, wow, that sounds so crazy.
Yeah. I mean, it really, every time I went up there, I just cherish those memories of, like, you know, I mean, I can't quite describe it, but yeah, it really was like going to Willy Wonka's chocolate. I mean, I heard about this, you know, he bought this old, you know, Tudor style house right around Fair Warning, I think, or
yeah,
you know, around 80, maybe Women and Children First. And that's where he always lived. And that's where the studio was. And it's this fabled place. And then to go there, I've got some pictures on the roof of that place that, wow, with, it was a repro Frankenstein guitar, but I've got some pictures that Matt Brook took of me up there that I really loved. And I also had they did them for the EVH gear site, but the I've got that Wolfgang guitar that they actually, Matt and Ed gave me that one, and there's some photos of on the roof that Matt took of me with that guitar and a Frankenstein guitar, and it's like palm trees and blue sky, and it's on the roof of 5150 with, you know, and I'm just like, this is like the freaking coolest thing ever, like the fact that I just feel like a kid at Disneyland, you know.
Absolutely
doing that stuff, you know.
That's so cool.
Amazing. That's a great story, Pete.
It really is.
It's a good story to end on.
I'm so sorry that for you being as intimate with the relationship with Eddie, I mean, that's a whole different level of loss.
Really is. Yeah.
Being a fan, and with Chris, you've had it twice in a short time, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot of loss. The difference with Ed, Chris was so unexpected. And in a way, Ed hits me hard, but I'm sad, but I'm happy too, because he
suffered a lot.
Yeah, he was a lot of illness and a lot of the, you know, like the last time I saw him was, you know, he was going through treatments and stuff, you know, dealing with stuff. And so I feel like he fought so hard, man. Like, folks don't know, like he was doing the best he could, man. And so, like, how hard can you, you know, it gets to that point where it's just like, man, you don't have to fight anymore now, at least, you know, you don't mm-hmm. have to fight. It's super sad that he's not here, but it wasn't one of those sudden,
right.
It's tragic, but it's like, we're all tragedies in the end. And I guess, like, aren't we, you know? And it's like,
yeah,
you know, and there comes to be a time where it's just like, I just felt like he was, I don't know. I mean, yeah, you want him to get back to healthy and stuff, but man, he's fought for so long. So yeah. With Chris, it was like such a shocker and out of the blue and just completely like, what? Like one day we were talking about MIDI cables on the phone, like earlier that week, or, you know, email, like he's having some issues with some stuff on the road. And we were trying to solve. So he was using one of my amps on the road, and there was a problem. We figured out it was with a cable and stuff. And so we were sorting out all that stuff. And then like 2 days later, he's gone. Like that's crazy. That was just like, it took like years to try and process that, you know,
yeah,
all of a sudden. So,
and what a void, though. I mean, like, you know, it's, you know, no one can do what Chris did, and no one can do what Ed did. You know what I mean? Like, those two guys, you know, obviously there's a number of artists, but really, I really feel like it's been an ongoing conversation since Ed passed, you know, how not only did guitar playing change, but guitars changed. Like, Ed had everything he did, all that innovation you're talking about, like, it just suddenly everybody wanted to be like that guy. You know what I mean? And that's
him and Hendrick, to me, where they came, the game changers. There's a lot of great guitar players. I said this the other day, it turned into a whole kind of, like, you know, like, because this can get into that, like, high school, like, who's better, Prince or Michael Jackson? Or whatever. You know, but
exactly.
Chris Rock said it best. I think Prince won that.
Yeah, right.
Totally. Yeah, I suppose so, yeah.
But no. It does get to be like that. But I think that with the, when you get into the exactly what you said, like the amount of impact. I mean, look at you with the red and white striped guitar on the wall back there. Like, and there's that impact of, like, changing guitar, what was possible, our idea of what was possible in the instrument, and then affecting every band that came after for a little while that was in the, at least a somewhat similar, I mean, everything from, like, really even into R&B music, and everybody had a hot guitar player with a Floyd Rosenthal guitar and a solo, you know, certainly after Michael Jackson then made the bridge on Beat It.
Even guys like Jeff Beck suddenly had, like, a Jackson with a Floyd Rose, you know, like, guys who were old school. It was like, you know, they changed the game.
Yeah, there was no Les Pauls. Slash was the guy that brought it back. I mean, there was no Les Paul. Les Pauls was, like, you know, there was Steve Clark, Def Leppard. Not very many people playing Les Pauls until Slash came along and made it cool.
Yeah,
so, it but was, Eddie, for that period of time, was everybody wanted a Strat with a Floyd and in crazy colors and graphics and finishes and
hockey stick headstock.
Yeah. You know, cranked up Marshalls and kind of party good time tunes, but nobody could match, like. The thing about Van Halen was so unique was, like, I was talking about, like, a song like Girl Gone Bad or a song like Hang 'Em High. There were these party fun tunes, like fun, but with the bridges and stuff that was going on, it was so intricate and musically. You had all these bands afterwards, some really cool music and some fun bands. I mean, bands like Rat and Warren and Dokken and Striper and, like, all these bands that came after and kind of did the party rock thing with a guitar player playing flashy stuff. But the level compositionally and the uniqueness of Eddie Van Halen was just, I felt like he was just on some other plane of, like.
There's almost a progressive rock moments in some of those Van Halen songs where you're like, I don't know what's going on here. Yeah. I'm unqualified to play this, you know?
And somehow Dave was magically able, you know, the B section in Unchained. All that stuff that's going on. And then Dave ties it together with a melody that makes sense on top that makes it feel normal.
You make a lot of all the records, really. But I mean, like, Beautiful Girls, the intro, it's like, what the hell is that? You know, or Fly, or, I mean, stuff. It's just like, there was Hendrix and then there was Eddie.
That's it, man.
I mean, like you say, there's so many great guitar players, but man.
And the chemistry of that band is another example of a band. I mean, obviously, you know, the fact that they went on and did just fine without Dave. But, you know, watching a lot of this footage I've been watching, because it's been a rabbit hole of just nonstop Van Halen, but what blows my mind is I'm like, I totally kind of just took for granted how amazing Ed and Mike would just come up and sing harmonies and just carry the whole show. Like, Dave could kind of, like, you know, just do his thing. Yeah. You know, like, sometimes he wouldn't sing at all, and you'd be like, those guys just holding it together. It was, like, brilliant. You know?
I forgot the fucking word. It was like, even better. Like, what band?
Exactly.
You know, and make it, it was unbelievable. But yeah, and not a lot of people give Ed the props maybe he deserves for how good he was as a singer. He was so solid on the low end while Mike was, you know,
he really was. Above him.
Everybody talks about Mike, but Ed was, you know, unbelievable. Well, Mike, I want to show you guys.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to show you a picture of something. I just have to find it.
It's a family show, just so you know.
No problem. No problem. No, you're going to love
just
this.
Kidding.
This is, I live in Pasadena now. Of course, Van Halen grew up in Pasadena.
Oh, I love Pasadena.
And it's a great town. It's really nice. It really
where was 5150 in Encino? Where was that?
Topanga.
It's really Studio City.
Where?
It's really Studio City.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, it's just up the hill in Studio City, really.
Oh, wow, okay.
Was it Benedict Canyon? Is that what hill?
Yeah, kind of going up Benedict, I think, is the cold water, right? You know?
Yeah, so, cold water. That's what it was.
Yeah. And so a home up there. And she, so, but they grew up in Pasadena. And I didn't know this until recently, but I guess they live in a house of two other families. And
I heard that.
Yeah. And I guess it's a, I was talking to Josh Freese the other day, and he knows the guy that lives in the house now. He's an engineer, I guess. It's,
wow. Oh, wow.
So this guy's got the house, but it's a nice house on a nice, you know, one of those old kind of like bungalow, you know, lots of craftsman houses around in this street in Pasadena. It's a beautiful street. And it's only about a half a mile from where I live now. So I drove by there the other day, and there's a lot of folks have been leaving flowers and stuff out front of the house. This is the house where, you know, Ed sat on the bed and learned how to play guitar and painted the guitar in the garage with the stripes and the whole nine yards right there at that house. So right around the, this is, you're gonna love this, right around the corner from the house, on the pavement is this going on. This is about a block and a half away from the house. And if you look closely under the neck of the guitar, you can see Van Halen carved into the concrete.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Oh, wow.
Eddie did that, allegedly. No shit. Eddie and not Alex, in about 1976 or so, like a couple years before they got signed is what I heard. Oh, you know, so wet cool. Concrete. Wet concrete jumps out of the car or whatever. Yeah, I got a car, you know, carved Van Halen in the curb, right?
Wow.
And so it's still there, man. And like, so this is on Allen Avenue in Pasadena. Just
north of I've never heard of that.
Yeah. And it's, I can't believe it's still there, that it hasn't been paved over or something. But you can see the chalk drawing and stuff all on the pavement, that somebody went and left chalk out, and there's massive all the way down the block, big Van Halen logos and people, "We love you, Eddie," and "Rest in peace," and just all the way down the block. And people have been leaving photos. I saw somebody there the other day, a video of a guy playing with a little practice amp, and he was sitting out there rocking Van Halen tunes on the curb. And so it's just like a little shrine. But I was saying to folks, like, this is the friggin' American dream, man. Like,
it is.
Scratch in the concrete, we are going to be something someday. You know, and back when he had no money and you know, was just struggling and writing their tunes, and there it is, you know, that's Van Halen.
Amazing.
It's a beautiful
amazing.
That's amazing.
That's really amazing.
Really so cool. So
that is awesome. Oh. And on that note, you know, it's great, and the stories have been fantastic, and we know you're a busy guy. Just want to thank you for coming on the show today. It's been fantastic. And if the YouTube and the gear thing doesn't work out, you've got a career in voiceovers.
Because, yeah.
You know,
I know,
it's,
right?
It's been fantastic. And what a pleasure. What a pleasure. I mean, to have somebody that's, you know, crystal clear and, you know, no hiccups. You know, we've been going for our little, you know, we try to tap into some of the Canadian guys up here where the with a dial-up internet, and it didn't really work so well. So.
It's a little more remote up there.
Yeah, exactly.
Thing too. Yeah.
Yeah, but the stories have been great, and sure we'll have to get you back on, because I know Fitzy had you know, wanted to be part of this, but he's driving home, so couldn't be. But you know, we'll have to get you back on. There's obviously tons to catch up on.
I'd love that, man. We spent a little time working in the same, like, I remember when he was working music stores in LA and stuff like that, doing, you know, like,
we're
going to make this happen, you know, and he's another one that's like, a, you know, God, he's dedicated and talented. And
I think all of us that came from Canada, and because it's a big leap to leave your homeland to the big, bad United States, you know, everything's so times 10 here. And just to make that move and come and do that, that takes a lot of guts. And I think anybody that comes down here to try and make it deserves kudos, you know, deserves big props for that.
Yeah, you work hard, and it's important to remember. It's crazy times. It's America. It's still, you know, we're going through crazy stuff right now. It's important to remember that. Like, it's that's what the country, that's what we saw as Canadians. The unlimited potential of,
right?
That's what it's about. And work hard and keep your nose down and stay out of trouble and work hard, and anything's possible. So,
well, and listening to the success stories, and like you said, the guys you're rubbing elbows with, I mean, you know, you're one of a few that had the opportunity to be touched by some of those greats. But on that note, I mean, how do you get any better than that? So if anybody wants to follow your YouTube channel, Pete, where do they go?
I mean, you can search Pete Thorne on YouTube, THORN, and it'll pop up. It's just youtube.com/Pete Thorne, and
go check out that.
Go get your last solo record, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
Pete Thorne 2. Oh, I was listening to it again. Dude.
I'm sure that's all on your website. Website, I believe it, Peter Thorne, is that it is?
I've actually got Pete Thorne and Peter Thorne. So it'll
there you go.
Yeah, thanks, Shane. I appreciate that.
The songs are wonderful. I remember listening to it a couple of years back when I got it initially, but I revisited it. It sounds so good, and all the guitar sound is phenomenal. It really is phenomenal playing.
I appreciate it. Time to do another one. I gotta stop being lazy.
Like, not just a couple songs up front. I mean, you know, top to bottom, that record is so good, dude.
Oh, thanks, man. The last tune is my favorite tune, personally. So, yeah. if anybody gets it, skip to the end. No,
there you go. Listen, well, go check that out. Yeah. Thanks everybody for tuning in today. If you like the show, you want to support the show, click the little stars button below, and be sure to tune in. Go check out all Pete's stuff. And again, thanks for coming on today. It's been fantastic. Not very many shows where we're just kind of in awe. I mean, you see everybody just sitting there hanging on those stories. They were fantastic. So,
thanks,
man. Thanks again, and we'll talk to everybody next week.
Thanks,
Pete. Bye, everybody.
See you later, guys.